to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening, and welcome to An Adventure in History. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital, here this evening with Mac Burns, director of the Clatsop County Historical Society. Good evening. How's it going?
It's going good, but you know what? The traveling exhibit away from home, it's down the last couple of days.
Oh, this is it.
It leaves May 25th.
And it is not coming back near us.
So now if you've been waiting to avoid the crowds, it might be too late.
Yeah.
But even then, the crowds are not bad at the Heritage Museum.
Not at all.
Every day, so including tomorrow, Monday, 10 to 5.
Great.
This is your chance. It's a great exhibit. It's a kick in the guts. It's amazing. It's powerful. It's just...
Away from home, looking at the boarding schools across America...
The Native American
boarding schools.
Let's clarify.
Yes.
Not some elite prep school on the East Coast in Massachusetts.
Correct. Although that might be interesting, too.
Well, that's kind of what my master's thesis is about.
Oh, really?
It's about a very expensive prep school in Los Alamos, New Mexico that was taken over for the Manhattan Project in World War II.
Oh.
So... So, yes, it is kind of interesting, I thought so.
Yes, very much.
But, so I had to do like an overview of some of those other prep schools. But,
okay.
But this was not a prep school. These are Native American boarding schools. A
couple more days, yes. So. Middle school and older is kind of the appropriate age group. You kind of have to gauge your own child.
You got to know your kid.
Yep.
All right. So we got a lot of stuff to talk about. Shall we get to it? All right. So let's see. These are things that happen tomorrow, May 24th.
Correct. Monday. Yep.
So you can be smart with all your friends, or these are conversation starters. If you don't know how to interact with somebody, this could be a good icebreaker.
There you go.
Did you know that happened on this day in 1543, astronomer Nicholas Copernicus dies?
I did not.
I like his name. I don't know why.
Yes.
Copernicus. It's just kind of fun to say. 1797, Thomas Jefferson inquires about a former flame.
Ooh.
And I didn't know anything about this, so I thought that we should delve a little deeper.
Of course.
So we're taking a tangent here.
All right.
So on May 24th, 1797, future President Thomas Jefferson writes to his friend Angelica Church, inquiring casually about their mutual friend, Maria Causeway, a woman who had once captured his heart and inspired a romantically themed essay.
So in 1786, a widowed Thomas Jefferson met Maria Causeway in Paris while he was serving as the U.S. minister to France. Causeway was born to English parents in Italy, and by the time she met Jefferson, had become an accomplished painter and musician. She was also married.
Uh-oh, I'm smelling trouble.
The two developed a deep friendship and possibly more, although a sexual relationship has never been proven. The usually self-contained Jefferson acted like a giddy schoolboy with Causeway, and at one point leaping over a stone fountain while the two were walking and falling, and he broke his right wrist in doing so. After the wrist healed, the chagrined Jefferson wrote his famous head and heart letter to Causeway in October of 1786, just after she left for London with her husband for an undetermined period of time. The letter reveals him to have been a lovesick man whose intellect battled with a heart aching for a woman he could not have.
In the head and heart letter, Jefferson pines for a woman who has made him the most wretched of all earthly beings, and at the same time chides himself for giving in to emotional attachments. The dialogue reveals Jefferson's struggle between his desire for Causeway and his wish to maintain his integrity. She was, after all, married. In the end, the head wins over the desires of the heart, and Jefferson declares that the only effective security against such pain of unrequited love is to retire within ourselves and to suffice for our own happiness. 2 years later, though, his letters to her still expressed an unrequited longing.
In 1787, Jefferson wrote to Causeway while traveling in Italy, painting an idyllic picture of the two of them together one day in the future. We will breakfast every day, go away to the desert, dine under the bowers of Marley, and forget that we are ever to part again. He wrote to her again in 1788 from Paris and expressed his tenderness of affection and wished for her presence, though he knew he had no right to ask.
Eventually, Jefferson's physical separation from Maria and the hopelessness of a relationship with her cooled his ardor. After returning to America in 1789, his letters to her grew less frequent, partly due to the fact that he was increasingly preoccupied by his position as President George Washington's Secretary of State. I can see how that might take a bit of time.
A little busy.
She, however, continued to write to him and vented her frustration at his growing aloofness. In his last letters, he spoke more of his scientific studies than of his love and desire for her, finally admitting that his love for her had been relegated to fond memories of when the relationship had been pure.
Cosway left England in 1789 after her husband died and moved to a village in Italy to open a convent school for girls.
Wow. I don't know why. I was very charmed by that. Or surprised, I should say, more.
Yes.
You know, you picture this founding father and a man of words, and it just seems a little amazing that he was like a giddy schoolboy and trips and breaks his wrist.
Yes.
So that was on this day in 1797. 1844, Samuel Morse demonstrates the telegraph with the message, "What hath God wrought?"
Ooh.
Couldn't we like say that about like when television started or when the internet started as well? 1856, Pottawatomie Massacre. John Brown and the abolition and some abolitionist settlers kill 5 pro-slavery settlers in Franklin County, Kansas. So I know I didn't see this, but there's like a TV show or a series or a movie about John Brown just recently.
Okay.
And I don't know how they portray him, but just for the record, he was cruel and insane. This massacre, it was bloody and brutal and disgusting. It was with machetes.
Mm.
And it was not just a simple, let's kill them. It was very, the people that found the bodies were traumatized for life.
Oh.
So I hope that this series did not, or the show did not make him seem like some wonderful hero.
Right.
Just had to get that out there. 1935, Major League Baseball holds first night game. The Cincinnati Reds beat the Philadelphia Phillies 2-1 in Cincinnati.
Ooh, that's a good one.
First night game. Okay, 1941, the German battleship, the Bismarck, sinks Britain's HMS Hood.
The Hood found the Bismarck, and on that fatal day, the Bismarck started firing 15 miles away. We gotta sink the Bismarck, was the battle sound. But when the smoke had cleared away, the mighty Hood went down.
Okay, that was an experiment. We've never done that on this show before.
He threw me.
But I love Johnny Horton, and because that anniversary, I just thought that's perfect.
That is great.
if you want to learn what happens, I just took it only through the Hood sinking.
Okay.
Because that was what happened this day in history.
Ooh.
So, but I have to admit, I have a stupid fondness for Johnny Horton and his historical songs.
There we go.
Okay, but the history highlight of the day, because
that
certainly was not it, was 1883, the Brooklyn Bridge opens.
Ooh, yeah, that is a good one.
So,
yeah, just a couple small
ones.
But
did I miss?
Yeah, 1878, the first American bicycle race is held in Boston. And I bring that up because today is my brother's birthday, and he loves bicycles.
Oh,
always
sweet.
Have. Our whole family is a big bicycling family, so I thought that he'd like that little tip.
And is he listening?
Of course.
Well, happy birthday.
Yes. Happy birthday, Aaron. We love you. Also 1930, Amy Johnson becomes the first woman to fly from England to Australia. This caught me because just last week, my 5-year-old asked me when she was old enough to go skydiving.
Oh, no.
And I have no idea
90,
where she even got that. I
mean, 90?
Yeah.
90.
Skydiving?
95.
To jump out of a plane. Whenever you're old enough to do it without me.
I was going to say, 5 years after you die, she's allowed to go.
There you go. And then 1951, Willie Mays begins playing for the New York Giants.
Ooh, Willie Mays.
Yeah, that was a good one.
That's fantastic. I usually get the baseball ones.
Yeah, I know. And I
left that one off.
Yeah, he's a good one. And he's still alive.
That's kind of amazing to me because he seems like he
shouldn't
was from,
be.
Like, from such an earlier time period.
Yep.
But anyway. Well, hey, speaking of... unfortunate deaths.
Yes.
We lost an icon, I think. And I mean, the last 10 years, I feel like we've lost a whole bunch of people that had a huge impact in Clatsop County. But this one was a little close to home. Russ Wohr, about 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago, passed away. And Russ was involved in tons of things.
Mm-hmm.
But for the Historical Society, I remember, I mean, he came to a lot of our events, but he's responsible for one of our main events.
Okay.
When I first came to town, I wanted to create talking tombstones. I had this idea. I'd seen it in another place, and I was shamelessly stealing it. But back then, I mean, we're still not flush as a museum, as a nonprofit organization, but we really didn't have any money back then. And this was 17 years ago. And I asked at the board meeting, I said, well, you know, we've got this great idea for this program, but we need a sponsor. And I said, the natural would be whoever makes tombstones. Does anybody know who the local tombstone maker is? I was so new to town. I didn't know Rust right. yet. I didn't know Astoria Granite Works. And board member Ken Easom is good friends with him and says very reluctantly, well, I know him. And I said, great, could you set up a meeting? You know, I'll make the ask. You don't have to be the guy that asked for the money, but I'll ask for the sponsorship. You just get me in the door. Just introduce me. And he calls me up the next day. He says, okay, we got a lunch date. And what I didn't know is that he didn't tell Russ that he was bringing his museum guy. He just says, hey, let's have lunch. So it's the Cannery Cafe that is long gone, but it was one of my favorite places. And we walk in together. Kent and I meet first, and we walk in. And Russ is already sitting there. And I can, without ever having met the man before, I could tell he was surprised. That, like, I thought we were just having lunch. Who's this other guy you brought with you? And he stands up, and Kent says, this is Mac, my museum guy. And Russ is still, like in a friendly way, but glaring at Kent. He doesn't turn to me, but he sticks out his hand. He's still looking at Kent, but he's shaking my hand. And the first thing he ever said to me, and this will burn in my memory forever, he says, how much is this going to cost me?
And he didn't even look at you.
He hadn't even looked at me yet. Hadn't said, hi, I'm Russ, or anything else. And before I say anything else, I say, just $1,000 is all. And he agreed to sponsor it. He came to the event the first year we did it. It was a rainy Sunday.
Wow.
And it was up on Hillside Pioneer, or Hillside Cemetery now. Mm-hmm. Hillside Cemetery in Astoria, which is a small cemetery, but we felt like it was the right one to do. We had 450 people show up in the rain.
Amazing.
And Russ stood there the entire time in the rain with a big grin on his face. And he gave his umbrella away to somebody that turned it in later and said, that guy gave it to me. I don't know who he was. And I went down to see him either the Monday or Tuesday afterwards. And I said, yeah, I just wanted to thank you. And he just had this amazing grin on his face. And he said, I never would have believed you could get 450 people to stand in a cemetery in the rain. He said, I've had phone calls from people thanking me for sponsoring it.
Aww.
That's never happened. And he just shook his head. And he said, you've got me forever. As long as I own Astoria Granite Works, I will sponsor this. And
that's
he did.
Good.
For the next 15 years or something, he sponsored Talking Tombstones.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I enjoyed so much going to visit him, you know, even if I was just dropping something off, it turned into a three-hour sit-down in his office just chatting about everything, life and everything else. But I think one of the reasons that he really liked talking to me and I really liked talking to him, or he faked it really well, one of the first times he mentioned something about that he'd worked for Sears when he first came to town in Astoria. He owned the Sears that is in the news again. The building is being redone.
Yeah.
But he said something about the president or something. I knew who the person was because I worked for Sears as a kid in college and in high school. And I had written a little bit in my master's thesis that ties into Sears a little bit. And he was surprised that I kind of had a working knowledge of the history of Sears. And we probably talked for about an hour for Sears. So in honor of Russ, and because it does affect our town that we had a Sears here, we thought we'd do the history of Sears.
I love it.
And if we actually interviewed him on the radio show October 27th, 2010. And it is on the Clatsop County Historical Society website.
Okay.
That episode is there with a previous co-host. Paulette and I interviewed him, and it's on the Astoria Museums with an S .org website.
I love
and
that.
And just go under research, and you'll see Adventure and History Radio Show. And then scroll down, and it was a great interview. He talked about Sears. He talked about Astoria Granite Works, but let's talk about Sears.
Okay.
Sears Roebuck & Company was a retail giant with 19th century roots as a mail order business operating in rural America. Sears grew into one of the nation's largest corporations, redefining the American shopping experience in the process. Its 130-year history embodies the rise and fall of American consumer culture. Here's how Sears became an American retail icon.
In 1886, Minnesota railway station agent Richard W. Sears bought a shipment of watches that a local jeweler refused to sign for. He established a side business selling the watches to other station agents for $14 apiece. Sears quit his railway job a few months later and established the R.W. Sears Watch Company in Minneapolis. He moved the business to Chicago the following year. An ad he had placed in a Chicago newspaper brought watchmaker Alva Roebuck into the business. And by 1893, the successful partnership officially became Sears Roebuck & Company. Sears and Roebuck quickly expanded the business into a general mail order catalog that catered to America's enormous 19th century rural population. Roughly two-thirds of Americans lived in rural areas in the late 1890s.
Local general stores were typically high-priced and offered little selection. The Sears catalog gave America's farm families a whole lot of options at a lower cost and often included delivery. It's the Amazon.
I know. I love it.
The Sears and Roebuck mail order business quickly took off. The Sears catalog contained more than 500 pages of merchandise by the late 1890s. Rural Americans could now purchase hundreds of different items: shoes, women's garments, wagons, fishing tackle, furniture, china, musical instruments, firearms, and bicycles by mail. And something about the catalog. Every good museum curator actually has a reproduction of the 1890, I believe, Sears catalog to look at, because sometimes when an object comes before us and we're like, we don't know what this is, if you look in the Sears catalog, you'll figure it out.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so I have one on my shelf, and there's one at the Heritage Museum.
Okay. Early Sears catalogs billed themselves as the cheapest supply house on earth, or the Book of Bargains, and featured a mind-boggling array of products, including medical and veterinary supplies, musical instruments, firearms, bicycles, sewing machines, and baby buggies. By 1894, the page count of the catalog was 322 pages. Richard Sears, who wrote almost all of the catalog's copy himself until his retirement in 1908, held the motto, "We can't afford to lose a customer," making sure that Sears stayed competitive in terms of price and value. Chicago clothing manufacturer Julian Rosenwald bought the company in 1895, though Sears remained president. Roebuck had resigned due to poor health. The company needed capital for its rapidly expanding business. So in 1906, Rosenwald and Sears sold stock on the open market. Sears has been publicly owned and traded ever since. Sears' simple, warm, and customer service-centered approach helped it stand out among mail-order competitors like Montgomery Ward. And I don't know the name of that one.
Hammaker Schlummer.
Okay. When Sears first sold stock to the public in 1906, the company was worth some $40 million, with close to $50 million in annual sales and around 9,000 employees. That same year, it built a distribution complex in Chicago with some 3 million square feet of floor space.
That's just huge. Okay, but I always think of Sears like walking into. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew about the catalogs, but so when did the first physical store happen?
Okay.
With the rise of the automobile, the mail order boom in the United States slowed down, but Sears managed to stay successful by expanding consumer credit with its no money down policy, and in 1924, opening its first retail store in Chicago. More than 300 Sears stores would open across the country by 1929. After launching the Kenmore brand appliances and Craftsman brand tools during the 1920s, Sears even expanded into auto insurance, launching Allstate in 1931.
I had no idea.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that connection. Even in the depths of the Great Depression in 1931, Sears' catalog retail and factory profits totaled more than $12 million, or more than $201 million in 2018 dollars. That year marked the first year retail sales outstripped catalog sales. In 1932, the company opened its famous flagship store on State and Van Buren streets in the Loop District of Chicago. While traditional department stores, Marshall, Fields, Wanamaker's, sold higher-end fashion, Sears had made its reputation selling less expensive but necessary items like socks, underwear, towels, and bedding, which helped keep sales going even during the Depression. In fact, by the end of the 1930s, the number of Sears retail stores had nearly doubled. And in 1945, well, they're expanding in the middle of the Depression.
Yeah.
In 1945, the company topped the $1 billion mark in sales for the first time.
Wow. So among the catalog's giants' astounding range of offerings were house kits, which the company began making in 1908. Now, these kits came in 447 different designs, from the Grand Magnolia, around $5,100 to $5,900, to the more humble but popular Winona, $744 to $1,900. Sears advertised the kits with the promise that we will furnish all the material to build this house design. All the parts arrived, usually by train, pre-cut and ready to assemble. From 1908 to 1940, Sears sold between 70,000 to 75,000 homes. Sears took advantage of the new home building materials and construction techniques at the turn of the 20th century. Mass-produced materials lowered manufacturing costs. Sears modern homes typically arrived with a detailed instruction manual and two boxcars worth of building materials. Kit homes used drywall, asphalt shingles, and balloon-style light frame construction to cut down on the cost of skilled labor and allow for do-it-yourself installation. Due to their high-quality materials and practical design, many Sears homes are still in use.
And in fact, and I really should have checked this before we came to record, there's somewhere between 6 and 10 Sears homes in Astoria.
Oh, I love that.
That are still lived in and are beautiful homes.
Oh, man.
And then the other thing I think about is, you know, I had trouble putting my kid's bike together like the night before Christmas. And this house comes in one or two giant boxes and people are putting it together. And it just amazes me.
And then IKEA comes along and we're all like, what? Yeah. What are we supposed to do?
That's right. We can't put together the shelf.
How do we do this?
Or it's lopsided when we're done. The Sears Wish Book, the first Sears Christmas Wish Book catalog, came out in 1933. The catalog contained toys and other holiday gifting merchandise. Items featured in the first catalog included the popular Miss Pigtails doll.
Sounds adorable.
Yeah, it does. Lionel Electric train sets, a Mickey Mouse watch, boxes of chocolate, and even live singing canaries. The catalog, which arrived in mailboxes in late August, early September, soon became a holiday tradition with warm, colorful Christmas scenes decorating the cover. The Wish Book began to diminish in size during the late 1990s and early 2000s as merchandising shifted to online purchases. I had this thing with my sister growing up that we'd flip open the page and I got the left side, she got the right side, and we had to pick like the best thing on that page that we would want.
Oh. That's one by one.
That's how we killed time, the entire catalog.
Yeah. I remember that catalog. I mean, because it was a big fat catalog.
It was.
Yeah. I don't remember it coming that early, but
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking October.
Yeah. But. I don't know. Maybe our parents hid it.
That's right.
Until a little later. As increasing numbers of Americans moved to cities in the 20th century, Sears faced the loss of rural consumers. City dwellers with easy access to a variety of stores had little need for the huge mail order catalogs. The company responded by opening its first brick-and-mortar department store in 1925 on Chicago's West Side. Early Sears department stores typically opened in working-class neighborhoods outside of the major city shopping districts. Sears was one of the first department stores to cater to men as well as women by selling tools and hardware. Its merchandise emphasized durability and practicality over fashion, and its store layout allowed customers to select goods without the aid of a clerk. In 1950s and 60s, Sears began to shift its focus from urban to suburban markets. The Sears name soon became synonymous with the suburban shopping experience. Their large department stores anchored shopping malls all over the country, and Sears catered to suburban motorists by expanding their automotive services.
The Sears Tower. Sears announced plans to build a new headquarters in downtown Chicago in 1969. At the time, Sears was the largest retailer in the world with approximately 350,000 employees. Hmm. When it opened in 1973, and let's see, 73, would Russ have worked for them yet? That's probably about the time period. When it opened in 1973, the 110-story Sears Tower at 1,454 feet in height dominated the Chicago skyline as the tallest building in the world, a distinction it held for 25 years. In 2009, the building was renamed Willis Tower after a London-based insurance broker that now leases a portion of the structure, or Willis Van Dusen, the former mayor of Astoria. I'm not sure which.
So Mark and I went to the Willis Tower.
Did you?
And, you know, I'm looking at the date now. Maybe it was 2009 because it had just changed names mm-hmm. around the time we went. And so it was amazing.
Was it?
We took a picture out on the deck, you know, where it's just glass underneath you. Yeah, scary.
Oh, that's scary. I don't like
very
that.
Very scary.
I would have kept my butt against the wall.
It was a very small, and it only could fit two people, and then somebody takes your picture.
Oh, that's just not right.
So yeah, if something's going to happen, it's only going to happen to two of you.
I've never been to Chicago.
Yeah, you got me on that city. One. Sears, Roebuck & Company gave birth to several iconic brands over the years. Some of them include Kenmore Appliances. The brand name first appeared on a sewing machine sold in the Sears catalog in 1913. Sears introduced the first Kenmore washing machine in 1927 and the first Kenmore vacuum cleaner in 1932. Throughout the 1970s, Sears continued to expand its Kenmore brand to household appliances, including refrigerators, freezers, and air conditioners.
Okay, I got to give a commercial here.
Yeah.
I have a Kenmore refrigerator that I bought back in Missouri when I lived there. I bought a house, put it in the house. It was like $350 from Sears. Lived in the house for 2 years with that fridge. And then we moved to Vermont, and I unplugged the fridge and took it with me because, you know, I bought a fridge. I'm not leaving it there. And the new owner didn't want it, so I took it with me. But we're renting a house when we're in Vermont. It already has a fridge, so I left it in the unheated garage for 2 years in Vermont through two very rough winters. Never plugged it in those 2 years, just sat it in the garage. We move here, and I have a house that already has a fridge. So I put it on the back porch in rainy environment of Astoria for 3 or 4 years without ever plugging it in. And then the fridge dies.
Shocking.
So I say, well, I have a fridge out on the back porch.
Oh.
So I move it in, plug it in, worked fine.
Oh my goodness.
And I still have that fridge and it still works. It's now 25 years old.
Oh my goodness. That's amazing. Next time, you know, you could have put it in your garage and plugged it in, Mac.
Yeah, well, that's what I have now.
Okay.
It's in the garage plugged in.
Okay.
I use it for the freezer.
Good. See?
But 5 years without being plugged in.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm like customer number one of like, wow.
So Craftsman, another good one. Sears acquired the Craftsman trademark and sold its first Craftsman tools in 1927. The brand's early customers were mostly farmers. Craftsman later branched out into lawnmowers, electronic, portable power tools, and even electric razors to serve a growing suburban base.
So we're not going to talk about the decline of Sears.
No.
Because that's sad.
No.
Because I also work for Sears and I have fond memories of it paid for part of my college.
And we have very fond memories of Russ.
You know, and I didn't give you a chance to share any if you had them, but you worked at the Chamber, so you probably knew him too.
Yes, he's a very lively man. Very, very kind, very nice.
Another icon. All right. Go make some history. We'll catch you next week. You just got a day or two left for the big exhibit, so make sure you come visit. Go make some history. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
May 27th, 1901, Seymour and Hill, the celebrated acrobats, will be seen this evening at the Louvre. They are noted throughout the country for their marvelously clever work in songs and dances as well as aerobatics, and will doubtless draw big houses.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.